see you. It's we're talking just at, over lunch that teachers have a huge influence on the students that come through, so it's an important thing that you guys do. So glad you're here. And so I'm going to tell you about the Large Hadron Collider, and I heard Damien said there was a lot of interest in it. And this is a picture of one of the detectors in the Large Hadron Collider. And I was searching the web for pictures to put in here, and you probably can't read this. You can read it. It says the Large Hadron Collider, it's going to... So it's... I found that because I was looking. I was giving a talk actually to someone, some other group, and I wanted a slide that had a prediction for the LHC. And so, so what they're thinking of there is, of course, this you know, it could make a black hole and end the world and that kind of thing. And so I'll talk about that at the very end, because it probably, you know, if we're lucky, it will make black holes. So that's a good thing, but it won't end the world. Yeah, also a good thing. So here's the way I want to tell it to you. I want to tell you about the machine and also how it broke. You know, because you know that it turned on in 2008, and then it turned off again in 2008, and so it started again. But it's not up to speed yet, and it won't be up to speed for a couple years probably. And I wanted to tell you what happened and why they're not up to speed. And then the next thing would be what's it aimed to do, and so that. The background there is particle physics and kind of what we know, and why we know it should fail, and so that goes in. The design parameters of the machine were partly aimed at trying to answer the question of what replaces the current theory, which is the standard called the standard model, and so the way that people thought about that is they thought about what was wrong with the standard model, which I'll tell you what those things are when we get there, and. Although we don't know what it's going to see, it's probably true that whatever is found will fall into one of three categories. And so I'm hoping that when I get here, you'll see what the categories are. And then that'll be it. I'll summarize. And I'll tell you what I think. I have a favorite category, and I think that it'll be the best one. But I'll tell you why when we get there. So here's the machine. It's the, there's two parts of the story. There's the accelerator, which is the, I'm sure you all know, but It's a 27-kilometer circumference ring underground near Geneva, in which protons are accelerated in opposite directions, and they go around and around and around and around zillions of times. And then there's four places in that ring. So there's two beams that are moving past each other, but they cross at four places. And so where they cross, collisions happen, and they build detectors around those collisions, which I'll get to next. But first, I'll tell you about the accelerator, and then I'll tell you about the detectors. So this is where it is. You could see it from space if you could see through the ground. It's big enough you could see it from space. So here's Lac Leman, Lake Geneva, and here's Geneva itself. There's the airport, and there's the mountains in the background. And that's why people like to be there. You're kind of looking south in this picture, so it's kind of there's a ridge here. When they built this thing, they tunneled around in both directions, and they met, and they were about a centimeter off from where they wanted to be when they met. But when they did that, they did all these amazing engineering things. As they came through the mountains down here, there's these underground streams that were coming through that they had to dig through. And so what they did is they would freeze them all with liquid nitrogen, and then they'd bore through, and then they'd melt it all again. And so that it's phenomenal what they did. So it's underground. And so here's kind of a schematic. We were looking that way before. Now we're looking along the valley. And so it's underground. And there's these tunnels that go down. And the CERN lab itself is kind of above this detector called ATLAS, which is where all the Canadians work. And the other general purpose detector is the CMS one that was on that first slide. And these two here, LHCb and ALICE, are kind of, they're aimed at specific kinds of physics. So this is aimed at B physics, and this is B quarks, are particular kinds of particles you'll see in a sec. And this is going to be for when they collide heavy ions rather than protons. So most of the main particle physics stuff is in these two detectors here. So this is what the tube looks like where the accelerator is. And there's thousands of magnets. The magnets are there because the charged particles, they want to go in a straight line. Have to make them go in a circle, and so the magnetic field is what does that. And they've got thousands, I think almost 10,000 magnets. And they lower them all down these holes. And they're just long enough that they can go around into the tube. And they put them on a train, and it goes 4 kilometers an hour around this 27-kilometer ring. And apparently one of the big problems was that the people driving the trains fell asleep as they're doing that because it's really boring. And so they... big deal to build it, but they put it all together. Here's the lab. And so the Swiss-French border kind of goes like that along the fence and across like this. And then this is Atlas is underneath that thing there. And there's this building here, if you saw the movie Angels and Demons, there's a big, it starts off, the first scene is this dome. And then there's these big mountains behind it. And the mountains are behind it, but you can't, they're way in the distance. So, you know, they kind of made the mountains look bigger so you know it was supposed to be near the dome. So there they are. That's the same. That's the dome. And that's what it really looks like if you're seeing. You can see there's no mountains that you can see really in the background. In fact, if you're seeing the mountains in the background, you're actually on the side that's not on the lab. So normally, the pictures that they took from the movie should have not seen mountains in the background. So I want to show you, and the first thing here, I want to show you some of the things. If you saw the movie, how many saw the movie Angels and Demons? Okay, I just want to show you how accurately they got it. This is the opening scene of the movie. They're going down, you know, you go down this tunnel, and then you see the accelerator, and then the plot of the movie, for those who haven't seen it, is they make antimatter with the LHC, and then someone steals it to make a bomb, and they try and destroy the Vatican or something. So it's the one that, you know, I read the Da Vinci Code, and I thought, gee, this is a really interesting book. I don't know anything about religion, but I wonder how well they got it. The other book he wrote is on physics. I'll read that one. And wow, it's amazing how little he knows about physics. It's really something. Anyway, you could talk about that forever. Anyway, so the movie does not so bad a job. They start off, they kind of go in, and this is what they showed in the movie, and then this is a picture I took of the same thing. They actually did the camera shot right in the tunnel. This is the Atlas detector at the bottom here. You're looking down from the ground, and they zoomed in, and they showed you this is what they showed you as you came down. There was the machine, and there was some sort of control room over here, and this is the machine. So they really were looking at these big muon detectors here, and this shows you the scale. This is what's hard to believe is if you took the Peace Tower, the Parliament buildings, like the tower would be sticking up the shaft, but the whole east block would fit into this cavern that they're in, and the detector fills it. So it's like a 5-story building underground. So it's really the scale of it is hard to see in these pictures, but this gives you an idea. These are the people, and this is kind of the detector, and that blue thing is where the beam would be. So then they turned the machine on in the movie, and this is the control room, and that was the detector outside the window. They're all wearing lab coats, of course, because that's what we do in movies. And so this is the real control room. There's no lab coats in sight. It's actually on the surface. You wouldn't act, you're not allowed to be near the detector when the thing is going on. There's a lot of radiation there, so they don't let you down there. But apart from that, it's accurate. This is all on the surface. So then the movie, they turn it on. It's a lot of fireballs, and then they collect this antimatter in a magnetic bottle, because otherwise it would destroy things. And there's a lot of other things that's true there. Like, so the antimatter is, the story about antimatter is that for every particle we know about, there's another particle that has exactly the same mass and exactly the opposite electric charge. And one way to think of that is that's just an experimental fact. And because they have the opposite charge, there's nothing that obstructs them from annihilating. So if an electron finds its antiparticle, it can combine, and there's no conservation laws that would forbid that from turning into anything else. And so it can turn into two photons, say, or so they can completely annihilate into other things. And there's a deep reason why they have to exist, antiparticles. It's consistency between special relativity and quantum mechanics is what tells you antiparticles have to exist. So it was a big success of theoretical physics that they were there. But they're mundane now. You produce them all the time. And it's true that when at the LHC, half the particles you produce are antiparticles, pretty much. So the movie got it right that there's lots of antiparticles being produced. And they got it right that it would be, if you could feel them, you'd have to put them in a magnetic bottle, because if you put them in a box, they'd find the anti-box would find the box, and there's no box anymore. So you have to kind of put it in the magnets, keep the antiparticles away from the walls. So that part is right. They make lots of antimatter. And you can make a great bomb out of antimatter because, chemical bombs are the energy of electrons being released. And the nuclear bombs are the binding energy of nuclei being released. And the binding energy of nuclei is about 1% of the mass of the nucleus is being converted to energy. But antimatter, you get it all, right? Because all the matter hits the antimatter and then it's gone. So it would be about 100 times more powerful, pound for pound, than a nuclear weapon would be, if you could make one. The thing that they get wrong is that you don't get many of them. If you run the LHC for 10 years, you get 10 to the 15 particles or something in these collisions. And it's such an Avogadro's number is 10 to the 23rd or something like that. So you're getting a little thimble full of particles. And so you have to really work hard to get to collect particles at all. And they did collect some antihydrogen. It took a long time to do it. And they kept it around. And they destroyed it after use. What that means is that they wanted to go home for Christmas. And someone would have to stay around and keep the refrigerators on. So they didn't bother. They turned it off. And then it hit the wall. And then it went away. So it wasn't dangerous or anything. But it's that's the part of the movie that wasn't really so true. The other thing that wasn't true is the thing they got wrong in the movie is they turned it on and it worked. So that's not really the way it worked. So what happened? So it started off well. This is a picture of the beam when they first turned it on. So you're really looking, this is the vacuum pipe, and this is one of the things, the protons are going that way, say, and the other ones are going that way. They were really where they're supposed to be. These little things were, they were in the window that they're supposed to be in. It was all working well. And then the incident happened. So in this ring, it was down here by the mountains that the incident happened. And what happened was that these, for reasons I'll tell you in a second, some of these magnets got like picked up, essentially put down, and these are like screwed into the concrete. So it's like someone picking a battleship up and dropping it. So a lot of energy was dumped. And the reason it got dumped, these are the magnets. There's thousands of them. This is when they were on the surface before they went in. And each one of those magnets has to be welded to the next one. And so the beam goes through here, and then these magnets are so powerful. That ring was originally built for a previous accelerator, which was not so energetic. And so to make this one in the same tunnel, they had to have stronger magnets. And so they can only do that with superconducting magnets. So the whole ring, 27 kilometers worth of it, is at 3 degrees Kelvin. So it's the biggest refrigerated thing on Earth. And so amongst these connections is basically the current for those for running the magnets, the electromagnets. But that current is all in a superconductor, and so the insulator for that current is actually copper. I mean, normally you make wires out of copper because that insulates really well, that carries current really well. But as far as the superconductor is concerned, that's an insulator because that has resistance. And so they use copper because it's relevant for how it broke. Is that if you ever lose this, if for some reason you warm those magnets up, they stop superconducting, and so all that current that's in the superconductor, you want it to go somewhere that's not going to damage things too much. And so that's what the copper's for. And so these are the welds, and this is the copper bar that is that was supposed to be protecting you if things weren't superconducting, and this is an x-ray through it, and you can see that the welds weren't very good. So in all these thousands of welds between the magnets, some of the welds were not very good. And so as long as everything was working, it wasn't going to matter because this was the insulating bar. But if you ever had a point where you didn't superconduct, then the current was going to want to go down here, and it wasn't going to be able to go down there. And then the energy has to go somewhere. And so what it does is it picks the magnet up and drops it. And then that knocks the next magnet over because they're all connected. And so then that knocks the next one over. And so they had planned on this happening to a couple magnets at a time, but 30 of them went off because the first few went off and did something. So here's a schematic. This is the superconducting. This is the insulating. This is how it's supposed to work. But then if it's not superconducting, the current goes here. But then if you don't have a good weld, the current can't go there. So you're screwed. And so this is kind of what happened. This is the damage, and then they've been repairing it ever since. And it's not just the physical damage. As soon as the protons, there's not a lot of them, so they're in a vacuum. And so that whole 27 kilometers is a very good vacuum. And, of course, as soon as you take one of the magnets and drop it like that, there's a whole bunch of crap goes down the vacuum tube. And so this is a picture of the tube. It's supposed to look like it's pink. That's the copper. But when you put crap in it, it looks like it's gray, and this is kind of what it looked like after they had the accident. So they had to replace a lot of these things. So they replaced this many magnets, and they repaired a whole bunch of them, but they didn't repair them all. And so the issue was, why don't you repair them all? And what can you do if you don't repair them all? And the problem is that to repair it so that the ring is in 8 pieces, and you cool and you heat up the each octant at once. And it takes, unfortunately, it takes some number of months to warm things to room temperature and fix things and cool them down. And so, first of all, it takes a long time to do the whole ring. But also, when you do that, the way you keep the superconductor cold is you have liquid helium. So if you want it at room temperature, you evaporate all that helium, and then you have to store the helium. and they don't have enough space for the helium. So if you want to do this, you have to actually, if you want to do the whole ring, you have to take the helium and put it into trucks and then drive the trucks away and then drive them back again when you want to cool it down again. So they're in the meantime building helium storage tanks, but there's it's just logistically difficult to do the whole ring. So what they did is they had to warm some areas to fix them, and then there's other areas that they didn't want to warm up. They wanted to see if they could run them. And so the trick is they have to know where have they got a bad weld without actually taking them all apart. So what they afterwards, when they once they knew what was going on, you could measure the resistance of the magnets, and there's a very, very small resistance, but you can measure it. And at room temperature, it's something like 50 microohms of resistance when you have a bad weld. But at when it's at 3 degrees Kelvin, it's less resistance than that, so it's harder to measure. So what they did is they took a, so here's a schematic of these are the 8 pieces of the ring, and the ones that are in red are the ones that got warmed up to room temperature, so you can see that 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of them were warmed up of the 8, and these 3 were never warmed up. And these were the ones where the repairs happened, but this one, they warmed it up so they could calibrate things. So they measured the welds when it was warm, and then they measured again when it was cold, so they could figure out, when they measure a resistance here, they could figure out how bad it was. And so based on that, they figured that they can run this accelerator at half the energy that it was designed to run at and be safe about having the same accident won't happen again. But if they want to run at full energy, they should eventually take these sectors and warm them up and fix them and then run. So the way they decided to do that was not to do it hodgepodge. They're going to just run till the end of next year at half the energy that they were designed to run at, and then close it down for 6 months and fix everything else, and then warm it up again, or then cool it down again, and then they'll run it at full energy. So at the end of the next year, they'll have about as much, they'll have recorded as many collisions as Fermilab in the States, which is the next most energetic accelerator, has done in its entirety. And so, but this will be a little bit higher energy. So that's kind of, they'll have a data set which will be comparable to the world data set now. And that'll be time, natural time to close it down and then upgrade it. So they did all that, and they started going. This is 2009 is when it started to run. You probably saw it in the news when they started it again. And they got the beams going, and there was a lot of excitement. So they set new world records, which I think in this case was the most people in the control room. I think that's actually that's when they actually passed the energy of Fermilab, I think, is the thing. And so they basically it's running. So it's been running since February. So the February was when they got going, and then it's been working really well. They've accumulated fewer collisions than they had hoped. But what happens is that the engineers figure out how things are working, and then the next weekend they'll accumulate as much collisions as they've had in the whole running of the LHC till that point. And so they may get fewer events than they expected to by the end of the 2 years, but it'll be, you know, roughly what they thought. So now what about the detectors? The detectors are important because you've got to know what happened. And Damien said that I had a sabbatical year over there in it was a year just before it broke, actually. I have an alibi. So when it broke, I was in Europe but not there. They had, but it was a great place to be because you actually got to see these things. And now when it runs, they won't let you down to see the detectors because it's there's radiation there. But then you could, and it was really impressive to see them. So I got to see the most important machine in CERN, and this is a joke, that's the coffee machine in the cafeteria. I also got to see the second most important machine in CERN, and that's the thing where the scale is hard to see. So you can see the people are over on the other side there. That's the same picture you saw before. So the detectors are these things that are at the bottom of these tunnels, and I wanted to say, so the purpose of this part of the talk is so why do they design them the way they are? What are they trying to do? So what you're trying to think is that they're trying to see what things are made out of. So atoms are made of nuclei and electrons, and nuclei are made of quarks, protons and neutrons and quarks and gluons. And the question is there stuff that's smaller than that? And are the laws that govern their interactions changing when you get down to small distances? But what you're doing is you're ultimately colliding two protons with each other. And the problem with protons is that they're not elementary themselves. They're made of things. And so it's kind of like colliding, you know, two garbage cans together and watching the spray of stuff and figuring out what was in the garbage can beforehand. But it's worse than that because so what's happening is all the things that are in the proton are colliding and you're getting particles and antiparticles. But most of those things that you get that are not already known decay. and they decay in 10 to the minus 23 seconds or something. So at the speed of light, those things go, what is it, 10 to the minus 23 minus 8 is 10 to the minus 15 centimeters, or 10 to the minus 15 meters. 10 to minus 50 meters, yeah. So they don't go far enough to see. So the new particles you're producing, you're producing them, but they decay immediately into ordinary particles we already know about. And what you actually see happening when so a proton comes in here, hits another proton here, and the spray of particles come out, the particles that come out are the ones we know about. It'll be protons, or it'll be muons or electrons or something. And the exercise is to see what came out, first identify what kinds of particles came out, what directions they went, what their energies were, say, and from that try and infer whether they came from the decay of something else. And you could do that by asking, does their momentum and energy add up to that of a particle? And basically it's reverse engineering what came out. And so the exercise is, can you see everything and identify everything as it comes out? And so there's a little movie here. This kind of shape that they always have is because they're trying to be hermetic. The collision happens and they want to identify everything. And then the different kinds of things here, the green versus the orange versus the blue, is aimed at identifying and differentiating different kinds of particles, which this movie is supposed to show you. So let me just... this little notebook takes a while to...
The detector consists of many components.
Yeah, they know they've got a budget when they got. I may have to actually just close another one. Oh, just.
And I have not
shown it. Sorry about this. This is a new netbook, and it's an experiment for me having netbooks, and I'm trying to think that they're not quite what I need. This is gonna take the detector apart and show you why different particles do different things.
The detector consists of many components. These are needed to measure the different types of particles produced in the collision, which then pass through ATLAS. The intersections measure the tracks of charged particles, which are bent by the magnetic field of a thin superconducting solenoidal magnet. Outside of all of these are two calorimeter devices measuring the energies of particles. Finally, the muon spectrometer measures the tracks of muons, which are bent in the field of the superconducting toroidal magnets. Here is how ATLAS detects different types of particles. An electron will plow through the inner detector, leaving a track behind before finally stopping in the electromagnetic calorimeter. A photon behaves in a similar way, but leaves no track. A proton leaves a track and interacts primarily in the hadronic calorimeter. A neutron behaves in a similar way, but leaves no track. A muon passes all the way through ATLAS, leaving tracks behind. Finally, a neutrino passes through ATLAS without being detected at all.
Down here, you can see it if it had a charge. Then the things that were light enough or did not interact, that were light enough essentially would stop, so that's photons and electrons. And the things that went farther than that, if they took part in the strong interactions, like protons and neutrons, they would stop in the next thing. But if they didn't, like muons, then they would go through that. And then if something gets to the muon detector, then it pretty much had to be muon because everything else will stop. And the neutrinos you don't see at all, and that makes things difficult. So what you have to do then is you say, well, if I see three things going out in this direction, something had to go out the other way to make momentum balance. And so that we can figure the neutrinos out by asking for conservation laws to work. But you can kind of see that it's not a simple thing to do, but it can be done. But they have to really understand the detector well, because it's almost always true that there will be, when you first set these detectors up, you see things like, it looks like energy is not conserved, or energy, and that's because the detector is not working over here. It wasn't that a neutrino went there, but it's just you didn't see the particle that went that way. So, all right, so that's what they do. And they're actually doing it. They were, while it was broken, they were doing it anyway because cosmic rays are always coming in from space, and they could use those. But now what they do is they see these things happen. And the additional challenge that they have that they've never had before in these accelerators is that it used to be that the protons are in bunches. So they you don't have collisions happening all the time, but only when the bunches meet each other. So they actually don't even look in the detector unless the bunch has been there, because cosmic rays are always going through the detector. And if you see something that was not when a bunch was in the colliding with another bunch, it couldn't have been to do with the collision. And so you don't care about those events. But in this case, what's happening is that there's so many particles in these bunches that it used to be that there was only going to be one collision every time a bunch met another bunch. But now there could be two or three collisions that happen. So you have a lot of particles coming out, but they're not necessarily even coming from the same collision. And so, and it's happening, 100 million times a second. So they don't have enough, there's not enough disk space in the world to write the all these events to tape. So what they do is they have a very sophisticated set of electronics that decides whether or not it's interesting enough to keep. And then they record those, and those are the ones, and they still have enormous amounts of data that come out. But it's a very huge data processing intensive undertaking to extract all these, to read out the detectors. And the internet, the World Wide Web was invented for this. So that was how it was invented in CERN, is that the various experimentalists were interested in sharing information in a way which was very transparent, and so they developed HTML and the clickable browsing software to do that. So they've written papers and they're measuring things, but the cool stuff hasn't happened yet because they're not up to speed. They're still trying to, what they're doing now is they're discovering the standard model. They're just finding the things that people know should be there, and that's the way they learn how the detectors work really well. And they have to do that to be able to find things that are unusual. So what are they trying to find? What am I aiming for, Damien? Oh, wow. Yeah, so you want to be... Right, okay. Okay, good. All right, so the basic story is it's reductionism. Things are made of smaller things, and we're explaining things in terms of what they're made out of, and the question is, what's the next level down? And they're down to now about 10 to the minus 17 centimeters, and this is going to get down another factor of 10 to 100, depending on how you count. And there's good reason. The reason they're doing that, the next few slides is supposed to convince you, is that there's reason to believe that there's something there. And the next few decades of distance should include something we don't understand, because there's hints of it already. So the context for that is the standard model. That's the currently successful theory. It was invented in the, depending on who you attribute it to, in the 60s. And it kind of got polished into the mid-70s. And then from then on, it's been tested. And it was expected to fail every time it was tested. So it was tested in the late 70s and the early 80s. And then it was, again, a new machine for which the tunnel, the LHCs, and was originally for an old machine that was built in the late 80s, which was meant to test the standard model very well. And it was expected it was going to fail there. But it didn't have to fail. But we thought it probably would fail, but it might not fail. It turns out it didn't fail. And so it's been tested for 20-odd years, almost 30-odd years, and it's only in the last 10-15, depending on how you count years, that there's been actually evidence, experimental evidence, that the standard model is failing. So we know that it's wrong in some way, and that's where I'm heading in this section. So it was invented by these people. This is Sheldon Glashow, Abdus-Salam, and Steven Weinberg. And so it's called the Weinberg-Salam model, and that pisses Glashow off no end. Because he did some preliminary stuff in the early 60s, and so But they were schoolmates together in high school, so they have this lifelong rivalry. So it's and then they shared the same Nobel Prize. It's a real story there. This is the particle content of the standard model. These things here are all the things that matter are made out of, and these are the ones that you normally see: the electron, the up and down quarks are what make protons and neutrons up. So almost all of ordinary matter is here. The neutrino is things that you see in radioactive decays, and these are just copies of them basically that are heavier, and typically only you see those in accelerators. And these are the things that mediate the forces between them. There's the photon for the electromagnetic force, the W and the Z for the weak forces, and the gluons for the strong force, and the graviton should be there too, because I think the modern picture is that the standard model really is plus general relativity. And that's everybody that's been seen. But the standard model actually has one more thing that hasn't been seen, the Higgs boson. So the first part of the story is why should you, so that's of course one thing you look for. And you needn't see the Higgs boson, but I want to convince you that something has to be seen. It's either the Higgs boson or something else that does what the Higgs boson is supposed to do. So what's the Higgs boson? This is Peter Higgs. The Higgs boson is inferred to be there because of what's called the Higgs mechanism, which is something which was invented by Grout, Englert, and Anderson. That's why it's called the Higgs mechanism. This is a story that Higgs tells. So it's what happened is sociology is really interesting. So what happened was these guys figured out what was going on in a very general way, but he had a really simple model that everybody got. And then he gave some talks that were very influential because everybody got it. So then they talk about this mechanism. Oh, it's the one that, it's the one that Higgs was talking about. And so that's why it became the Higgs mechanism. So it's but the idea is that there's the standard model, which is just describes very well the properties of the particles we do see. If it didn't have the Higgs particle in it, it makes a prediction for the masses of the particles, and they're all zero. So everything should move at the speed of light. And that was a puzzle. That was what went between when Glashow first proposed the precursor to the standard model in the 62 or 61, and when Weinberg and Salam actually proposed the real model in 67 or 68. In between, they were trying to figure out what happened. You can't take it seriously because there's supposed to be masses, and all the masses are zero in this theory. And the reason they're zero was because of a symmetry. It wasn't like they could think that there's a calculation that said there's zero, but if they did it more accurately somehow, they'd be non-zero, and that's the answer. There was really a very general property of the theory that said there's a symmetry in the problem that says you can't have masses for these particles. And that was basically the obstruction. It was a very general, robust conclusion. But otherwise, the model looked really, really good. And so, and then that's not crazy in the sense that they did predict things that seemed to be seen. And so the question was, how do you reconcile the things? And the picture was, what broke the logjam was that you have to distinguish between symmetries of your equations of motion and symmetries of the solutions to the equations of motion. And so it's very much like a ferromagnet or something, where the laws of physics are rotationally invariant, say, but the object you're looking at might not be rotationally invariant. And that's not inconsistent, because you can have solutions to rotationally invariant equations of motion which are not rotationally invariant themselves. And the inference that said that these particles had to be massless, was a statement about the solutions, because it was saying we live in a world where these particles are moving through the vacuum, or the absence of particles. And the implicit thought everyone had was that the vacuum was nothing. So they didn't think of that as a solution in some level. It was zero. But really, the vacuum is a solution, and it doesn't have the same symmetry properties of your equations of motion, and that's the way the standard model works, is that you should think of the vacuum as being much like, before Einstein, it's like an ether. It's a medium. It's like living in, if you're a fish living in water, you can infer a lot of the properties of water just from the way you move through it, and different things move with different resistance, and those, how do you measure mass? You apply a force and you see what the acceleration is, and the different accelerations for a given force, those are different masses. So the way you'd say these things are different masses because they have different resistances to what they're moving through, and it's moving through the vacuum is what gives us mass in the standard model. The laws of nature would have forbidden mass if the solution that describes the vacuum hadn't broken the symmetry that forbade the mass. So that's a very deep observation that carries a lot of information with it. In particular, this doesn't tell you what the Higgs particle is yet. This is what the Higgs mechanism is. It's the ordering of the vacuum. The Higgs particle says that if you really think the vacuum has physical properties like that, then there's consequences. If you bang it with something, it'll vibrate. And so the waves in that vacuum, that's what the Higgs particles are. So the if you take the vacuum and you disturb it somehow, you'll send ripples into that vacuum, just like you have ripples in the electromagnetic field. And those particles, look like particles to us, and we'd see them in accelerators. And so those are the Higgs particles. And the thing is, you know a lot about their properties, because the reason you think they're there is that they're giving you mass. So that tells you right away that the more massive you are, the more you couple to this thing, whatever it is. So if you want to see the Higgs particle, it's going to like to decay into the heaviest thing it can possibly decay into, because that's what it couples to the most strongly. And so a lot of its properties are nailed down by the fact of the way you're inferring its existence. But the basic statement is that the vacuum has properties, and mass is what we see as the response to how we move through the vacuum. And that means that the vacuum, this liquid analogy is actually very good. If we heat the vacuum up, it'll melt. You know, you can change the structure of the vacuum by changing its properties. And so experiments have been done to try and do that. If you really change the vacuum, then you're screwed at some level. So you don't want to all be massless at once. That's a bad place to be. And the LHC won't do that. Don't worry about that. But in principle, when you talk about cosmology in the early universe, when it's hotter, we believe that at one point the vacuum was different, that particles that are now massive were massless, and that changes how the universe would have behaved in the early universe. So that's the model, and I show you that just because it's not very pretty. People oversell the utility of beauty in physics. This is an example which is not very beautiful, I think. But there is a sense in which it's beautiful. It has an inner beauty, as they say. And that inner beauty is that if you take that particle list that I gave you, including the Higgs particle, and you say, what's the most general way it could behave at low energies, consistent with quantum mechanics and special relativity, the answer is the standard model. It's a very similar statement to what we know about Maxwell's equations that describe electromagnetism. If you have a long-range force mediated between charges, a spin one particle that's massless in the modern language, the only way that can interact at low energies, consistent with things like the Coulomb interaction, is through Maxwell's equations. And the same thing for gravity. If you have a long-range force that's mediated between energy, between energies, the dynamics of that at low energy has to be described by Einstein's equations. And that's the consequence of the sense of general relativity, or special relativity in quantum mechanics being consistent with one another. It's the same kind of argument that gives you antiparticles. And so there's a very beautiful thing to that, in that we understand kind of no one's expecting Maxwell's equations to fail when you look in the LHC, because there's a very general way in which it's true. If you see something wrong with the standard model, something very basic has to change. You can't kind of make this into 2 lambda rather than lambda. You know, you have to really change something fundamental. You have to change the particles that you're looking at, or you have to say that you're not at low energy. So that means there's a particle you don't know about, which is actually not so heavy compared to the ones you know about. So something fundamental has to change. You can't just tweak the model to make it work. And so that's a very powerful statement about what... That's one, part of the reason why things like string theory or quantum gravity are hard to test, because once you get things roughly right, you get the details right. So it's difficult to see what's going on if you think you're perturbing this a little bit. All right, so why do you believe it's true? It gets a lot of experiments right, and here's an example. This is a plot of the... This is in those experiments that were done in the tunnel the LHC's in now, but the previous accelerator that was there. It was taking electrons and positrons, which are point-like particles, so they're very, very well understood, and colliding them and looking at what came out. In this case, they're looking at things like protons coming out. And they're looking at the number of times that happens as a function of the energy with which they collide these things in the center of mass frame. And these are the red dots are the ones that were done in CERN, where the LHC is now. And then the purple dots were also done at CERN, looking at a different kind of a collision. And the green dots were done in the old days in California and in Germany. And you see that the black curve is the standard model prediction. And this big bump is where the Z boson is. And so it kind of is supposed to be there. And you see that the theory works really, really well. And to give you an idea of how accurate it is, this is a picture of, if you're looking at kind of a part per thousand or part per 10,000 accuracy, this is the measurement of a whole bunch of things to do with those collisions, and this is the theoretical prediction, and it gives you an idea how well we're doing. This is the difference between theory and experiment is standard deviation, so they're all less than 3, and so basically that says that the theory works really well. Some things better than others, but it's a very, very accurate, it's a very redundant test. There's about 3 parameters in the standard model predict all these things. And the fact that you're getting 20-odd observables described by 3 parameters extremely well tells you you're on the right page. So it works really well. To get the energy right, you have to do that plot as a function of energy. You have to know the energy very well in your beam. And there was a story that went around in the early 90s. It used to, these plots I showed you would work really well on a weekday, but on the weekends they didn't work so well. And they couldn't figure out why the standard model was failing on the weekends. And it turns out that the TGV is a train that runs from Geneva to Lyon. And its schedule changes in the weekends. And it turns out that it's an electrically driven train, like most of the trains are in Europe. And the current from the train, when it leaves the train, is trying to go to ground. And ground in the Geneva area is Lake Geneva. And the best way to get there from a railroad track turns out to be this big ring of metal underground. So it would go down into the ring, and it would go around the ring, and then into the lake. And that changed the energy the electrons had. And it changed the inference you're making at the cross-section. And so they detected the TGV on the weekends, and so they actually found the schedule. They could match the SNCF schedule, and it was working. They also actually measured the moon, because when the moon goes overhead, the tidal flexing of the mountains changed the dimensions of the ring enough that they could actually measure that. So it was really, really a fantastically precision science that they were running. When they had a lot of snow run off into Lake Geneva, they could detect that too. It's phenomenal. The main reason I want to tell you this is that the Higgs particle, we haven't seen it. And if you're looking for it, one of the things you have to ask is how heavy is it? Because if it's too heavy, you'll never produce it at the energies that the LHC has. And the precision with which the standard model is tested is useful because it actually also constrains the properties of the Higgs particle. And that's because the Higgs particle, although you haven't seen it, it plays a role in the predictions you're making. And so this is, to illustrate that, this is a prediction for, across the bottom here is the mass of the W particle, which is one of those particles in the standard model. That's something that you get to calculate in the standard model. It's not a parameter. And this is the measured value. So it's this 80 point something, and this is the error in the measurement. And then this is the prediction in the standard model for that mass as a function of what the Higgs mass is. And this is the theoretical error in the prediction. And you can see that they agree, but only if the Higgs mass is quite light. This is a logarithmic plot. The units are GeV, which is basically the mass of a proton. And so this is about 80 times the mass of the proton. And Higgs, if it's more than about 100 or 150 times the mass of the proton, say, that's 200 there, then you're disagreeing. The standard model will be disagreeing with what you measure when you measure the W mass. So the Higgs particle, the standard model Higgs particle, not only does it couple mostly to heavy particles, its properties are extremely well known. And so if you see a particle that could be the Higgs particle, you'll know if it's exactly the Higgs particle because you know exactly what its properties are if it's coming from the standard model. What's wrong with the standard model? Why do you think it's wrong? Well, there's three, take it to the bank problems with the standard model. One of them is the neutrinos. Neutrinos are predicted in the standard model to have no mass, and the fact that the vacuum has got funny properties doesn't change that, really. And we now know that neutrinos do have a mass because of a collection of experiments that started off in the 60s measuring the number of neutrinos coming from the sun. And what happened there was neutrinos are produced in the reactions that drive the sun. The sun is burning hydrogen into helium, so ultimately, at the end of the day, it's turning two protons into two neutrons every time four protons become one helium. But every time a proton becomes a neutron, it produces an electron and a neutrino. And since you know how bright the sun is, you know how often that happened. And so you know how many neutrinos are coming out of there. So you can count them. And so then you can detect them. You know how many make it to the Earth, and it's not that many. It's actually not that small. Every square centimeter like that, at the surface of the Earth, there's 10 billion neutrinos going through it every second from the sun. And so the fact that you didn't know that shows you how weak the neutrinos are. And there's a story that if everybody in the world closed their eyes, neutrinos, when they're in water, can hit an electron and make the electron move faster than light in water. And so there's a Charing clock. There'd be a blue flash of light if that happened. That's one of the ways to detect neutrinos. And so that would happen in your eyes every once in a while. But you have to have it, your eyes have to be closed, so you don't get, that light is not drowned out by the general light around you. And you have to be awake. And so that doesn't happen very often. And so that's it happens, but it's the problem is that the awake factor is what gets you. But if you make a big tank of water or a big tank of cleaning fluid, they actually first did it as a cleaning fluid, a big tank of chlorine. The neutrinos hit the chlorine and they turn chlorine to argon, not very often, but every once in a while they do. So they have tons of chlorine, and every month they get three argon atoms. And every 3 months they'd flush the tank of chlorine and they'd count the argon atoms. And they'd get 8, plus or minus 2. So they'd get 8, they wouldn't get 4, they wouldn't get 12, they'd get 8. And they were supposed to get, you know, 12, because that's what the sun should have been sending us. And so that was the problem. The solar neutrino problem was that they were getting fewer neutrinos than they should have been coming from the sun. And everybody's reaction was, you know, yeah, you can really count 8 argon atoms and a ton of chlorine. There's no way you're getting that right. You're just making a mistake. Or, so they had another experiment, which was not cleaning fluid, it was water. And then 4 or 5 experiments all had the same answer. And they said, well, you don't understand the sun well enough. It's complicated. Because most of these 10 billion neutrinos are not energetic enough to be seen in these detectors. So you're only looking for very rare neutrinos. And so it wasn't crazy to think that you didn't understand the sun. But as they got better and better at it, they got more and more robust tests, and it really became clear that something was missing. But the thing that really aced it was this thing in Sudbury, the solar neutrino experiment. Because all the experiments before that, there's actually 3 kinds of neutrinos. And the fact that they've got a mass, the reason that's relevant for this experiment is that the mass allows the neutrino that's emitted from the sun to be different from the neutrino that arrives at Earth. It means that a better way to say that would have been that the standard model predicts that the neutrino that's emitted from the sun, there's only one neutrino that's emitted from the sun. Because neutrinos have a mass, it means that actually all 3 of them are being emitted from the sun with some probability. And so if you're missing some in the ones you thought were supposed to be coming, if there was a mass of neutrinos, you should be seeing the other ones appearing. But no one had actually been able to look for them until the SNOW experiment. So the SNOW experiment was designed to see these other neutrinos, and what they found was that not only they confirmed that we're missing these guys, but they confirmed that these guys are appearing in the amount that you would need to replace the ones that were missing. And then it all adds up to what you would need to account for the brightness of the sun. So that really nailed it. But there were still skeptics. And the skeptics said, well, we don't really understand the sun that well. So what they did is they made a beam of neutrinos on Earth and did the same experiment where you look for downstream from that beam. And they still saw that they're missing. So that it's been reproduced on the Earth as well as in space. And so it was really a very clear case that there's something wrong with standard model in neutrinos. There's also in cosmology a case that there's something wrong, probably with the standard model or with gravity or something with what we understand has to change. There's a whole story there, of course. The conservative way to deal with that is that there's a new kind of a particle around, because the evidence here is that for the first time in the history of science, people have been able to measure the energy density of the universe reliably without actually looking at how bright the universe is. You don't have to count the stars. You can just measure how the universe gravitates. And that was possible because of the precision cosmological experiments in the 90s. And the survey showed that the surprise was that everything that the chemists talked about is here. That's the periodic table. That's all the protons, electrons, and neutrons. And then the 96% of what's out there is something else, and 2 kinds of something else. Don't know what they are, but there's 2 different kinds of them. So the joke I always like to have is that this is the chemists, and then the physicists get this. Because one of the problems is, what is that stuff? And there's 2 ways to go on that. One of them is you're inferring its existence through gravity. So if you're using the wrong rules for gravity, you might be inferring the existence of stuff that's not there because really gravity is different. That, I think, the evidence now, people, there are proponents on either side, but I think it's fair to say that the consensus on the evidence is that that's difficult to make work, and no one's really made that work. But the dark matter is very easy to interpret in terms of there is an easy interpretation of both these things, which comes with caveats. The dark energy is very easily understood as being it's plausibly understood as being the energy density of the vacuum itself, which has got physical properties, can have energy density. That would gravitate, and that would look like dark energy. But dark matter, I told you there's lots of particles that are likely to be produced at the LHC. They all decay really quickly. But if one of them didn't decay for some reason, say it was stable for some reason, that would be dark matter, because the abundance of the dark matter that you would predict in the early universe from the early universe being around now is something you can calculate from its properties, because the universe in an early time was very hot, and so hot things have a very uniform abundance. And as the universe cools, you can predict very accurately what the abundances should be. And what you find is that if you have interactions and masses for particles that are kind of typical of what we know about the particles that we do see, like the W boson, say, then that would give you the right abundance for dark matter. But the particles we do know about, like the W boson, don't do that because they decay. So if you just didn't decay, that would be a great model of dark matter. And so that picture of dark matter is a very easy picture to make work. It just smells so right that I think if you had to bet money now, that's the best bet. But if it is right, you can test it because you know its properties. And so there are detectors like in Sudbury looking for those particles. But whatever it is, it's not in the standard model, so something has got to change. There's also a bunch of theoretical problems, which I'm going to skip through because they're not. Well, I'll talk about one of them. I have to talk about one thing to just give you the three categories at the very end. So the one I'm going to talk about is the hierarchy problem. It's the statement that it's basically the question: why is gravity so weak compared to the other interactions that we know about? That doesn't sound like that's a problem. It sounds like that's an observation. First, you could say, well, how do you know gravity is weak? And that's the statement that astrophysical objects are big, because the mass of the sun turns out to be the mass, the Planck mass, which is the mass you get from Newton's constant and Planck's constant and the speed of light, cubed divided by the proton mass squared in ballpark numbers. And that formula is true because something like the sun is built by the competition between gravity, which wants the sun to collapse, fighting the nuclear reactions that are driving the sun's heat. And to get two forces to balance each other, given that one of them is really weak, like gravity, means that you have to have a lot of stuff. Because pound for pound, the nuclear force wants to beat gravity a lot. And so the fact that the sun is so large is a reflection of the fact that gravity is such a weak force trying to balance the nuclear reaction in that case. But what the winning thing for gravity is that it's nothing repels under gravity, so it's always attractive. And so you get enough stuff, eventually gravity can win. But whereas in electromagnetism, you can always cancel charges against each other. So the problem is, why is gravity so weak? And the reason I want to convince you that this is not kind of a problem that may be solved in our lifetime, maybe not. This is a compelling problem that should be solved at the LHC. And that's because that's kind of hard to get across. But the essence of it is that the problem basically is that remember the vacuum has physical properties. That's where mass is coming from. So this is showing you the phase diagram of water, which is another thing which has physical properties that we could be living in. This is pressure, this is temperature, and this is for these temperatures and pressures, water is steam. So this is where it's liquid, and this is where it's solid. There's various kinds of solids, depending on how the lattice of the ice is arranged. And the units here, an atmosphere, I think, is 10 to the 5 pascals. So that's has water boiling at 373 Kelvin, which is right. And so this point here, the interesting thing here is that this black line is the coexistence curve between liquid and gas, and it stops at some point. So if you take steam and you make it really, really, really hot, and then you raise the pressure on it, and you cool it down again, you can get liquid without ever going through a boiling point where it just sits there and has latent heat that it's boiling off. And that is called a critical point. And I'm telling you all this because the way you think about the vacuum is that it's like water, that we're living in some phase diagram somewhere. And there's things here like the energy or the heat that we have around, and there's things like the density of stuff that's around, the number of particles around. And we can imagine moving around like this and changing the phase. But the main thing is that the characteristic points like this, so if you kind of ask why is the critical point, this point here for water, in something like the ballpark of 100 degrees, in the ballpark of a million pascals, you can estimate that given the fact that you know the energies associated with atoms. And because basically you're talking about the arrangement of water molecules, and that's all to do with the energy of arrangement of the electrons in the water. And so the scale of the energy in atoms is what tells you the rough scale of the temperatures and the pressures that are going to describe points like this that are in the phase diagram. And it would be really weird for water to find that the critical point there was down at zero, say, temperature. That would be really hard to understand. And the situation we have in the standard model is much like that, that if we think of the scales that we know about in nature, we know there's a lot of particle physics scales that I've been talking about, which are all in the kind of the ballpark of a proton mass. And then we know that there's a scale, a mass scale to do with Newton's constant, which is 10 to the 18 times bigger than that. And that's a very much smaller distance scale. And the picture we normally have is that the small scales are the fundamental things, and we describe the big things as being made of those things. And so if it's true that the fundamental scale of the world is some very small scale, which we think because gravity is so weak, then that's like setting the scale of the atoms in water. That's telling you kind of what the rough scale of the problem is. If you have something happening in the vacuum, you expect it to be happening at roughly that scale. And we're not. We're seeing the properties of the vacuum that we move through that give us mass are giving us masses that are very, very, very light. That's like finding that there was a phase transition at some extremely small temperature compared to the basic scale in the problem. And that's more or less what the hierarchy problem is in the standard model. We believe that the standard model is a glimpse onto what's going on at smaller distances that we can't probe. But the fact, if that were really what was going on, all the laws of physics that we know would actually predict that the masses of the particles we would find would be very, very large. In particular, the masses of the scales of physics associated with the vacuum we move through would not be as small as they are. And so a lot of thought has gone into fixing that, because to fix that, the way you fix that, that means that the next scale that we're talking about isn't going to be that small. It should be bigger. And it, actually, this argument would point to it being not so much different from the scale that we can see. So there's an argument here that I'm kind of skating around, but it distinguishes about the various things I've talked about as being a problem which should have as its resolution something that is not too different from the scale. We should find whatever fixes the problem soon when we go down and as we look down to smaller scales. It shouldn't be something which has to wait until we get down to the Planck scale. It's something which we should be able to solve in the next accelerator. And the LHC was designed to find what does that, in addition to finding things like the Higgs particle. So what do you see in the LHC? The options are nothing. You can rule that option out, because we already know that the standard model would be without the Higgs is crap. And we know it's crap because you can do things like you can calculate and measure the scattering of W particles, say, as a function of energy. It turns out to go like the fine structure constant, which is a coupling constant squared, times the logarithm of the energy divided by the mass of the W particle squared. And that can't be true, because we know also that quantum mechanics says that, you know, these are waves at some level. And if you have a wave that's got a wavelength that's a certain size, and you try and scatter it from a rock which is very small, it doesn't even see it. The wave goes right by a small rock. If you have a big rock, it'll go around the rock or diffract around it. But you can't scatter from things that are too small compared to the wavelength of the thing you're trying to scatter from. So a general feature of quantum mechanics says, if you translate that into what that means as a function of what the likelihood of scattering is as a function of energy, it means that things have to fall off, like scattering rates have to fall off like 1 over the energy squared for large energies. So this can't work. At energies of the order of when alpha squared over m squared is of the order of the energy squared, that has to be where the theory goes bad if you had no Higgs. And the standard model, of course, doesn't do this. The standard model has a Higgs, and so it has a contribution corresponding to the exchange of the Higgs between these two W particles. I should have said that the other things were the W particle could exchange a photon or a Z, or it could just directly interact with itself. But when you include the Higgs, what happens is that there's a cancellation which makes things fall off like they're supposed to at large energies. And so the standard model could make sense to very large energies. But you have to have something like the Higgs. The Higgs or something like the Higgs have to be there. Otherwise, there's something very fundamental we don't understand about quantum mechanics and relativity. So the likely thing is that you're getting something there, and you know where it has to be. It has to be 100 times bigger. This alpha is 100, is a 1 over 100. It has to be 100 times bigger than the mass of the W particle, and that's kind of where the LHC is going to be. Well, can you see the Higgs boson itself? If you can't, then they should fire everybody who built the LHC. And this next two slides are supposed to show you that it can be done, but it's not easy. So it's not going to be the first thing you hear. If you ask what they're going to see as they announce stuff, if what they find is the Higgs, it'll be one of the later things that they announce, because it's a complicated game. And the reason it's complicated is this. Remember, the Higgs is the thing to do with the vacuum. And what we know about the vacuum is it's giving us mass. So the more massive you are, the more strongly you couple to it. So now if you're the Higgs particle, you want to decay, you'd like to decay into the heaviest thing you can decay into. But you can't decay into something heavier than you are, because then you can't conserve energy. So what the Higgs particle decays into depends on how heavy it is. And so what you look for in these things, you're never going to see the Higgs particle if decaying too fast, you're looking for what it decayed into. So your strategy will depend on how heavy it is, because that'll depend on what it decays into. So what this is showing you is the statement, this is the likelihood of the Higgs particle decaying into various things as a function of its mass. And this is showing you that at low masses, it likes to decay almost all the time into, this is a log plot, so the 100% of the time is the top, 10 to minus 1 is 10% of the time. BB is two quarks. Those happen to be the next heaviest thing to the Higgs if it's down here somewhere. And so it always goes into two B quarks until it's about this heavy, and then that curve drops off. And then things that are heavier start to become more likely, and then it likes to decay into W bosons, which are heavier, and pretty much all the way up. But if you're in here somewhere, there'll be some trade-off between the various kinds of particles that are there. And the thing is, they're not all equally easy to see in these detectors. So they have to have different kinds of strategies depending on what the mass is. And the next slide just basically is a slide that convinces you they can do it. So they claim they can do it. So what that slide was this is supposed to be the statistical significance of the discovery as a function of the kind of particle you're decaying into. And if it's more than this, then they can see it statistically, it's 5 sigma. And so this is showing you that they can see it, but it's different kinds of reactions they're seeing it with, depending on the mass. Is what that's showing. I need to finish up here. So beyond the standard model, there's three things. The main message is three things. Three things are aimed at this if the standard model works, so one possibility is the standard model is all you're going to see. You're going to find the Higgs particle, and that's it. That's the worst case scenario for theorists, because the theory has been done, and then they're testing it. But it's a logical possibility, and it would still be very deep, because it's told you something about the vacuum, and you've experimentally determined that the vacuum had to have properties, and you've measured those properties. So it would be a scientific triumph, but it would be personally boring for me. Now, the hierarchy problem, and things like dark matter and neutrinos are pointing to other kinds of physics, and there's three kinds of physics they point to. And so let me just close with those three things. So the first thing is the conservative option. In the past, what's happened? You found that the things you thought were elementary were made of other things. And so option number one is that'll continue to happen, that the quarks or the electrons or something will be made of something else. And the favorite candidate here is the Higgs itself. So people often think of the Higgs aimed at this hierarchy problem I was talking about. One way to think about that problem would be if the Higgs was made of something else, then that could solve that problem. And the reason people think that is that is a story I can, if someone asks, I can tell you. But there's a fairly simple reason. So that's the conservative option. The second option is supersymmetry. It says that it predicts that for every particle that we know about, there's another particle we don't know about which has very similar properties, same electric charge. Some properties are different. The mass doesn't have to be the same. But that requirement is being built in because that's the kind of thing that could make the basic scale of the problem, like the energies in the water molecule, be different from the properties of the vacuum that you'd see in that kind of a picture. And this is probably the option that people, if you took a poll amongst physicists, would say is the most likely option. It's the best understood option in the sense that it involves the most easily controlled kind of calculations. And people really believe they can make predictions and make predictions seem to work. So, for example, you might kind of balk at the idea of having the same duplicates of all the particles we know about, but that's actually already happened once. Because in the 30s, people predicted that there should be antiparticles. And that said that for every particle you know about, there's another one that has exactly very correlated properties to the ones you know about, and it has to be there on a very fundamental reasons, and they were there, it turns out. So we could be about to have another antiparticle moment in the sense that supersymmetry would be like that, that we're predicting partners that were related to the ones we've seen. And if the world were like this, the ones we have seen would be the ones we'd expect to see. The ones that would be light would be the ones that we have seen. And so just to give you an idea of why people find this compelling is that here's another one of those comparisons between the standard model and experiment. This is showing you the top quark mass compared to the W quark mass, the W boson mass. Those are two particles that this one is the one that you just have to measure, you can't calculate. This is the one you get to calculate. This is what the standard model predicts for the W boson as a function of the top quark. I showed you previously the W boson as a function of the Higgs mass. This is the same idea but with the top quark mass. And so here's what the standard model predicts. And here's the measurement. And so with some standard, some 3 sigma or whatever it is, you have to be living inside this blue circle. But if you did the same thing with the supersymmetric standard model, it's the green area. And so that actually agrees better than the standard model does with what they measure. So that's one of the reasons why people think that actually has the right kind of smell to it. But it's not statistically compelling yet, because it's only 3 standard deviations, and it's a suggestion rather than something which is true. Another thing like that is that if you take the strength of the interactions we have and extrapolate them to higher energies, then in general, if the world were a unified place at high energies, you'd expect them to meet somewhere. And if in the standard model, they don't meet. They all kind of go up, and then these two cross, and then they later on cross. But if you had done this in a supersymmetric world, it turns out that they do meet at one spot. And that's very suggestive that maybe there's something going on there. And it doesn't have to be like that, but it's again suggestive. Now, the third idea is the radical idea. It says that the whole problem with the hierarchy problem was that the basic scales that we see in experiments, like the proton mass, are very different from the scales that we get from gravity. But those aren't masses. Those are just things that are, those are mass-like things we're inferring from Newton's constant, the strength of a force. If we had done the same thing with the weak interactions, the weak interactions are due to the exchange of the W boson, who's got a mass of 80 times the proton mass. But if we took the coupling, like Newton's constant for the weak interactions, and said, what's the mass that I would get by combining it with H bar and C the way we do to get the Planck mass, you would have inferred a mass of 250, or 246 times the mass of the proton. And the difference is factors of coupling constants and things. It's understood in the standard model, but it turns out that in gravity, those dimensionless factors could be very big. You could imagine the scale of gravity could be much stronger than we think it is, it turns out. And there's one way in which that can happen. And it was a way which took a while to realize. So this third option was only available after about 1995. These other ones were kind of almost immediately available when people started thinking about it. But this way, he says that if there were extra dimensions rather than the four that we see, then gravity could be much stronger because the force lines of gravity could be all going into the extra dimension, and then you wouldn't see them. And all you're measuring are the parts of the force lines that are kind of in our dimension. So if you imagine drawing, if we have a dimension that we see in a small dimension we don't see, and there's a mass somewhere, and all the force lines are radiating out, the force lines, if you kind of ask why is Newton's law a one over inverse square law, and why is that the same as the Coulomb law, that's because force lines are conserved at some level. And if you kind of draw a little circle around a source, like a charge or a mass, then the number of force lines coming out of that circle have to be the same no matter how big the sphere is. And so the area of the sphere goes like r squared, and so that tells you that the forces have to all go like 1 over r squared if you're living in 3 dimensions. But if you're living in 9 space dimensions, then spheres are, what would they be? They go like radius to the 8th power. And so forces would fall like 1 over radius to the 8th power in 9 dimensions. So a strong force would fall faster in extra dimensions. But once you look on distances large compared to the extra dimensions, the force lines can't go that way anymore, so they all start to straighten out. And so what was, say, 1 over 8th power law becomes a 1 over r squared power law because now they're all being forced to go the same direction. And so the statement is that a much stronger force of gravity could look like a weak force of gravity if there were extra dimensions around, but it would depend on how big the extra dimensions were, how diluted the force of gravity would appear to be. And it didn't have to work, but it does work, that the numbers are such that you could have the strength of gravity could be actually right there in your face in the LHC, and you could be seeing quantum gravity and black holes at the LHC, and that could be consistent with the strength of gravity that we know about. And so the reason that's relevant to the hierarchy problem is that would say that there is no fundamental scale more fundamental than what we're going to see at the LHC. It's just that we were fooled to think that there was something more fundamental by making an inference based on Newton's constant, which wasn't really directly a physical mass. So those are the options. This is the exponential slide. The black holes weren't crazy. This is the scenario that would give you them, because if gravity is important at the LHC, it'll do things. It'll make black holes. It won't eat the Earth. And one of the things that's great about the web is that you can see, if you ever look for these slides of the damage done at the LHC, it's hard to find those, because if you Google damage at LHC, you find this. And the graphics is always really, really good. And the stuff that you get at the official sites are fairly crappy. So the black hole scenario is kind of, it comes with territory. But they get a whole bunch of details right. I have to show you this because, there's actually movies. You should go to these websites because they have movies with a rock theme and it's kind of eating the Earth. Here's Geneva. Here's the black hole forming. And I just have this is some snaps of the movie. Here's France has been eaten. And then there's more and it kind of eats the whole world. And then you kind of, there's a big molten thing inside. But the details are, here's where the LHC would have been. And they have the black hole forming here. And CERN's over here. The lab is actually here, I think. And that's exactly right, because the ATLAS was here, CMS is here, the protons get injected here, the first time they meet would be on the other side. And so they're getting details like that right when they do these things. And so there are counter arguments that people make, that you're going to make black holes, but they're not going to eat the Earth, because one of the reasons that you believe they're not going to eat the Earth is that we're being bombarded by much more energetic particles from space than we can make at the LHC, and we haven't been eaten by the Earth wasn't eaten by those. But there's counterarguments to that, which are not crazy either. They say, well, that's true, but those things were moving very fast. The black holes are also moving, so they were not in the center mass frame, and so they went right through the Earth. But here, they're at rest, and so they're going to sit there, and they're going to follow the Earth. And so they have enough physics to hurt themselves, these people. But the problem really is that you're going to rule that option out, too, because it's not just the Earth. It's stars and neutron stars, very dense things that would have stopped these things. And the fact that they exist at all, the experiment has been done. It's not a theoretical argument. It's just, we also believe we understand black holes better than that. They evaporate. If you produce a black hole, it's going to explode, which will be cool because you'll see it in the detector, but it won't be dangerous. So this is what they do. This is the official CERN thing. If you look for has the Hadron Collider been destroyed yet? The CERN site says this. but wait for it. If you go to the page source, and you look in here, it says, if the LHC actually destroys the Earth and this page hasn't been updated yet, then email mike@frantic.org to receive a full refund. So the main thing you get there is that, you know, you'll never beat these guys. These guys have a lot of time on their hands. And you can't compete with that. Anyway, so what's the bottom line? Bottom line is, the LHC, it's very rare you can predict a revolution in science, but in particle physics, it's an experimentally driven science, and it's almost certainly that the LHC is going to find something revolutionary. And so in the next, I would say, 5-10 years, revolutions have to happen. This is one of the few things that a scientist gets to call a holy shit moment in science, and it's happening. So you know, enjoy it. You're living the dream here. It's going to tell us, at the very least, if the Higgs mechanism works, how it works in detail, what its properties are. But more likely, it's going to be a surprise, because every time you've really probed new scales at this, like this before, there's been a surprise in the past. So sorry for running so long.
And your question period is really short now.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I have to keep it short, but we do have a little bit of time for questions, and then you go to a coffee break, despite the battle. And so, thank you for your appreciation. Questions? Yep.
So, the question was, the weirdest thing I remember with the LHC this year was, did it break itself from the future?
Oh, yeah, right, that was weird. That was embarrassing, actually. The guy who did that was a very prestigious, very creative thinker, but he's kind of gone off a little bit. He's getting old, and he's not really all there. And it was kind of embarrassing that I can't remember who was it who put it in the press, but it was they were quoting a paper he wrote, which was said that, and he was a crazy. And he's a, that's not really one of the Of course, I could just be told to tell you that in the future.
There is an urban legend that in the year that the Americans did the experiments with the military Navy ship with the huge electromagnetic fields, and, you know, with the help of Einstein, and they made it disappear. They tried to make it invisible. But instead they make it disappear, not taking into consideration that they changed not only the space but the time, and those sailors managed to be in different, you know, time-space moments, and, you know, there was a lot of disaster, blah, 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 blah. Uh-huh. Do you expect, or at least hope, to do something like that with them?
Well, you know, if it's true that the gravity is the thing that they see in the LHC, which I think is what they're going to see, that only works if the extra dimensions, if your extra dimensions are big. And not only that, we have to, in addition to having big extra dimensions, they have to be so big that we would have seen them if you were living in them, because they have to be like micron across, or something like that. So it's bigger than some cells in the body, you know, that's a great one. And so in this picture, the only way you can avoid having seen them is that. Another thing that happens in these theories of gravity, like Dirichlet dimensions, is that there's often surfaces in this series that you have on. String theory does this all the time. If you have strings that have, the strings either have no ends or they have ends, and the ones that have ends, the ends have to end somewhere, and they end on a surface, which is a big object in space. And if you look at string theory, where an electron is, it's often one of these strings that has ends. And if you try to pull it off the surface, what happens is that you pull it and it costs energy because you're stretching the string. Eventually the string breaks, and what happens is that you get a loop, which is graviton or something, and you're still stuck with the string on the surface. You can't actually move it from the surface. So it's like a defect in a solid where there's something which is trapped in the defect. So it just happens in these theories that we should be taking them seriously, because they are the only candidates we have of a real theory of quantum gravity. It is the best tested one we have. They often predict that the particles we know about are trapped on surfaces, and so. And then that gives you another way you could avoid having seen extra dimensions, not just because they're small, it could just be the things you're looking for them, but they're also stuck on the surface. And if you're looking for photons that you would be at the LHC, it's harder to see them. And in that case, you can only see them using gravity, because that is space and time. And so that comes to testing Newton's law. And if you ask how well does Newton's law test, the linear square law, it's tested very well down to about, I think, 45 microns. So it happens that it didn't have to be true that we could
live with dimensions large enough to make gravity weak enough. But it happens that we're on the edge, so that it could be true. But it has to be, if you do see gravity at the LHC, you're going to see extra dimensions, you're going to see parallel universes that could be, you'd be talking about, there's lots of cool things that could be seen. I think that's what we're going to see, not just because I might like that, that would be wonderful, but I think there's a reason why we're going to see that.
Yes or no answer? That's it. Time. Will Higgs boson, yes, Higgs mechanism, Higgs field, will that allow us to have a better understanding of expansion and the inflationary period? Inflationary event?
Probably no.
Right. Good.
Just because the energies are wrong.
Okay. Perfect.
And probably is because if you wanted to make a model that made you head them, I could make one, but it's not very possible. Okay. Just the scales that you pointed to are just going to be good.
Your interests and your fields, they're kind of wide-ranging, more so than normal, is that right?
Well, it's not that way, but it's not really true. You know, it's the connection, say, between cosmology and particle physics is that there's a lot of particle physics that do cosmology, and that's because in the past, the universe was really much smaller, and so you have to know the laws of physics of those physicists to figure out what the universe is doing. And it happens that since the mid-early 90s, there have been observations from early enough in the universe that they could pair what was going on at very early times where the universe was small enough that you really had to know what was beyond the standard model. Mm-hmm. So that's one piece of experimental evidence where the physicists are pragmatic. So we'll take the evidence wherever we get it. And so if it's coming from cosmology, we'll take it from cosmology. And that's what's driving it. And it's also true that there's been a long waiting period where there haven't been experiments on the ground that have been decisively testing that's beyond the standard model. So you go where the information is.
Okay, we might last question before coffee break. So, yes?
But that's interesting. You know, in Rutherford's time, it was very symmetrical situation when theoretical physics was strong, yeah? And at the same time, you had Rutherford and his field, school, that, you know, somehow in some terms, the theoretical and experimental physics were really at the level, you know, as philosophy at the same level. But even with LHC, do you think that experimental physics, do you feel that experimental physics at your level right now, theoretical, or they're a little behind?
That depends. I think the difference between us and you, I think you're right that in the late 19th century, theoretical physics, you know, there were these famous quotes that, I can't remember earlier, where it said that physics is more or less over, you need to lose details. That's just before they started quantum mechanics. And the difference now is that theory is ahead, but we really believe that there's problems with the theory that we have, and so we're expecting something to happen. So that's the main difference. So on the experimental side, then it depends on what they find. So if they find, you know, supposing they find that the standard models, the supersymmetry is true, and it's kind of a garden variety, white vanilla, white spread. But that's actually a little bit boring because it's kind of like standard model again. We more or less understand things, and it would be really interesting to revolutionize the world. But at the level of it won't be an experiment completely oversharing the random part. Whereas the most interesting thing would be, I suppose, if they found nothing. The thing I told you that you never find. That would say that there's something about relativity and quantum mechanics that we don't. There's something very fundamental that's wrong, and that would be a everybody would have no base. If the ground would have moved underneath our feet, then we'd have to start from scratch. And so it could be either of us. You know, so that's the great thing they do, the experiments. They find out that things they think are really sure are false, and that's the most interesting outcome for theorists. But I think it's, you know, if you have to bet money, I think that the betting money is that it'll be exciting in the sense that there'll be a whole bunch of things to figure out as to what things are made out of. But the basic rules that we're working with are not going to change. It will still be quantum field theory, it will still be something like that. Unless, the closest thing to changing that would be if it's gravity in your face, because then it could be string theory, it could be something else besides string theory. I mean, we don't know that much about quantum gravity. So that's the best case. That's the best, most plausible case I can think of.
Okay. Thank you. So